Okay. Now, as you would have heard on this programme yesterday, during Community Garda information, there was a strange event in six tractors and a forklift were stolen from a yard. Now, that in and of itself is very inconvenient for the plant owner. But then they were brought on a so-called joyride, and I know some people don't use that phrase because it kind of sets a wrong tone. But anyway, they were taken then to the green area, the shared area, and made a mess of the green. Then they were abandoned and the culprits fled. Andrew McGonigal is chair of the Malin Development Association. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Greg.
Like, it is a strange one, isn't it? And it's really regrettable.
Yeah, it's disappointing to say the least. Like, our village green is one of our features in our town, and we spent a lot of effort in maintaining it, keeping it grass cut, trees pruned and all that, and it's just disappointing to see that sort of antisocial behaviour. Of course it is.
How hard is it going to be to restore the green to its former glory? I know it's the time of year where it, you know, everything doesn't look as best as it can anyway, as we're just starting to see growth return, but is it going to be difficult to get it back up to ship shape?
No, not too bad. There's quite a bit of flex done on it, but it could have been worse. It could have been far worse. So we're happy enough with that part of it. But we will work. We have had one guy working on it, Rick Hugh McCullen, has already done some work on it, and we will fertilise it and put sand and all on it to get it back to its original state.
Do you think those responsible sort of did it on purpose? Was it just a bit of horseplay? Maybe they don't realise what they're doing. They think in their minds that this is fun. They don't realise the consequences. They don't realise that the community feels attacked.
Yeah, the community does feel attacked, and it's antisocial behaviour. I think they don't realise. They don't seem interested in what they're doing or why they're doing it. They don't seem to know what they're. I can't understand their psyche of what they would try and do something like that, because it's antisocial, as I say. It's well organised, because there must have been at least five or six of them,
yeah.
So they've obviously discussed this or worked on it.
That's what makes it really quite weird. And why, yes. Tractors and a forklift? I mean, I don't know. Is it for? Yes. Are these videos going to appear on TikTok or something? Or I'm not saying it's young people that are doing it, but I mean, as you say, there's a plan here. What are they hoping to achieve? It's not like these are high powered vehicles. There's not much fun in taking a forklift for a spin.
No, and it's the danger of it on the road in the middle of the night. Five tractors. I mean, anything could have happened. Any sort of accident could have happened. And then, but you're into criminal activity then. So, yeah, the whole thing is disappointing, and I don't understand why they would want to do something like that. It would happen sometimes, occasionally, Halloween night. We would sort of put up with that, but this is just not Halloween night, and this is a wrong thing to do, basically.
Are you calling on those responsible to come forward? Or if it is younger people, you know, maybe parents or guardians might sort of say, well, you know, what were you doing at 4:30 in the morning?
Yes.
You know, I think this is going to kind of be a community response here. I don't think anyone wants anyone hung, drawn and quartered. Well, people need to realise that this is not proper behaviour.
Exactly, yeah. I don't understand why they would do it at all, as you're saying, yeah. Like, we're disappointed as a committee. We're very disappointed because we spent a lot of time and effort into keeping our community and maintaining our community and our environment, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why young people would want to do that. I can accept it sort of Halloween, it's just a challenge. But this is about concerted effort to just get on the town green and try and do damage.
It's not the first incident, unfortunately, in recent times. What else has happened?
On Friday night as well, we had an issue with a dumper truck stolen, moved from a council area where they were doing new footpaths for us, and sort of low loader was taken onto the green. That was Friday night, and then the same thing happened on Sunday night. So, yeah, whether it's the same people or not, we don't know.
Any information to the guards, Andrew? I think these people need to be talked to and explain the consequences of their actions that they're putting. I'm not saying it's locals, Andrew, but I can't imagine there's not a crew from Donegal Town coming up to take tractors and a forklift on a run either. So, like, as I say, I don't want to cast a cloud over any group of people or any particular area, but look at maybe it is people from the vicinity, and maybe they don't realise that it's their own family potentially that they're putting out here.
Exactly, yeah. Like, they obviously knew where the tractors were based, so they have to be locals to an extent. They might be 10 miles, and certainly not more than 5 or 6 miles away from here. But, no, they don't seem to realise what they're doing is wrong, but that's the way it is.
All right.
It's a favour. What do you do?
Andrew, keep up the great work up in Mallon. It's beautiful, and I'm sure you'll have the green back in ship shape in no time at all. Hopefully not have to speak to you in this context again, and we'll chat in the future again, and more positive things, Andrew.
Thank you very much indeed, Greg.
Take care. Best of luck to you and all the crew up there. As I say, it's pointless. It's not even fun. Come on, you can't tell me it was fun. Do those videos pop up on social media anywhere, I wonder? I'm sure someone had the phone out. Another great organisation, Letterkenny Tidy Towns, they're having their AGM on Wednesday, the 8th of February. That is tonight at 8 p.m. It's in the Station House Hotel, Letterkenny. Everyone's welcome. If you're interested in getting involved with the 2023 project, it would be great to see you there, coming from the organisers. That's the Letterkenny Tidy Towns. Always glad to see new faces, I'm sure. Tonight, 8 p.m. in the Station House Hotel, Letterkenny. All are welcome. Listener said, Greg, I needed NowDoc over the weekend with a sick baby. I called at 4 p.m. and was called back an hour later. At 6 o'clock, I was in the car park and was told to sit in the car because the waiting area inside was full. Once I got inside, I had to wait another 3 hours. In that 3 hour time space, 5 people in front of me left unseen. These are already clearly people who were deemed in need of care by a triage nurse. This is a service that they are looking at changing and could face cuts. It's not cuts it needs, it's an increase. Another morning, Greg. Can I highlight the streetlight out this last month on Lifford Main Street? It's pole number 12. I've contacted ESB and was told it subcontractors will be contacted to contact them. It's been reported, but it's not been fixed. We can't, as residents, even see to get the key into the front door. We're concerned for our safety of our elderly residents and our cars with the streets so dark at night. Well, look, we're going to make inquiries in that, aren't we, Caroline? Yes, we are, because we promised at the start of the show, if you give us a call, we'll try and sort things out for you. So we'll see what we can do. That's a light on Lifford Main Street. And your concerns are for obvious reasons. Leave it with us. We'll see if we can move that along for you. Greg, waking up. It's called badness. Of course, these young ones know they're doing wrong. It's going on far too much. They should be made to make good the wrong. I understand, and I'm sorry. I do sometimes maybe come across as a little bit too forgiving. I just think that maybe sometimes young people don't know. That's all. And if they realised, they might not do it. But again, maybe I'm being naive. And I apologise for that. From Callum. It shows with power, women in politics, that a great job that politicians, Michelle O'Neill for Sinn Féin, and trying to get Ireland together. Another here. There's a bigger elephant in the room in relation to women in politics, which is political parties, which are mostly self-serving. It's the same all over the world. It's all about power. They say Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael spent years on civil war politics, yet when it meant that they might lose power, they suddenly threw away any values and took power. There's always a compromise when it comes to gaining power. The modern-day Sinn Féin politicians also stood on no on abortion because they were a pro-life party, but then turned to yes because it meant votes. Okay, that's that listener's opinion. Right, okay, shall we take a break and clear the decks for Dr. Joe Kelly, who is of course a historian. We're going to be talking history very, very shortly. Caller says, some mobile Vodafones are not able to make contact with my landline and other Vodafones. Has anyone else experienced this? Thank you. So do you have particular issues with contacting certain mobile phone operators from your landline? A caller's wondering if they're on their own. A caller says, listen, there are plenty of Gardaí, and instead of community Garda, they haven't a clue to blend into the community, and better still, they don't want to accept it's to benefit themselves, full stop. All these type of Garda are dead now that could have a normal everyday chat with the public when walking the streets. I don't know, if you give them the time and the space to go into schools and engage with people on the street. I'm sure there's plenty of Gardaí currently that would be fit to do it. Drew Harris says this listener is in a unique position to investigate and resolve the gravest mass murder in the history of the state, the Dublin and Monaghan bombings. If he's not interested in this mass murder, as they describe it here, then he's hardly going to be bothered about Garda resources in Donegal, given his background in the dirty war in the six counties and following recent senior appointments in the Gardaí. Then citizens of this state are oblivious to the policy direction of An Garda Síochána. This is from a person with family members in the force, they say. Greg, just a wee shout out about my two-year-old slipped and split the inside of his lip and needed stitches on Saturday. I want to say a massive thank you to all the staff in Casualty. They were fantastic. I can't thank them enough. I got another thank you from a listener that I was supposed to read out. Someone helped them. I'll try and find that. Sometimes the messaging my inbox be wedged and I try and remember to mention something and then I forget. Hello Greg, my husband got a letter from Revenue last don't know what happened there. My husband got a letter from Revenue last week about tax. He's on an old age pension for years. He doesn't pay tax. It wasn't his PRSI number. We'll be very careful of that because there are still people that will try and scam you by way of postage as well. If it wasn't his PRSI number, I would disregard it because that's the identifier for him. Though there's probably someone with the same name waiting on that letter that might not receive it. Greg, what about a discussion on the news that Donegal's dog wardens issued only 10 fines in as many years to irresponsible dog owners? Does not exactly fill you with confidence if you've young kids out and about. Well, listen, unfortunately, that's just been a trend for as long as... Whenever we're having the conversation, it's about enforcement, isn't it? It's not just that. It's dog fouling and dogs misbehaving or being off leads. There's zero enforcement, really, if the truth be told. Hi, Greg. Let me see here now. Hi, Greg. I would call them real thugs that wrecked lovely Malin Green. Of course, they knew what they were doing. They see not to do it in the middle of the day when people would see them. Pure thugs doing it when people are in their beds. Just hopefully there are cameras to catch them. Would just love that to happen. Okay, I get you. I understand. I'm reading the room and maybe I'm being a little bit too generous in my comments. Hi, Greg. Since the new year, I know of 10 people that have taken their own lives. Really, something needs to be done about the mental health of our people. That comes in from Sean. Sean, it's something we've tried to discuss on this program a couple of times because these are personal tragedies and you can't speak or you don't wish to speak about them in the wake of these tragedies. But I understand where you're coming from, and I think we all know that there are an awful lot of people taking their lives of all different backgrounds and ages and gender, and we need to find an approach to reach these people to give them an alternative. Is that the right way of phrasing it? We can't just sit idly by, but we have to find a way to do so in that it doesn't exacerbate an issue or trigger it either. But there are people that we need to reach to speak to give them information, to give them help. And I'm open to any suggestions in how we can use this programme to do it, because in any other area of life, and we did speak to Dr. Dennis McCauley last week, and we have spoken about this issue in the past, and we've tried to get the numbers out there, and we've tried to let people know how important and special they are and to reach out. But we need to come up. We need to find something else, another way, I think, don't we? Because there's too many families just devastated, ripped apart. And I know some of you are listening to this, and I know you feel that pain every single day. And I don't know if we could just come together to try and come up with something that will try and reduce that number that the listener talked of there. Caller says, read the pro-abortion v pro-life text you just read out. It's a sad day for humanity. If one has to be pro-abortion to be successful, it's time the pro-life people of Donegal stood up for the right to life, the right not to be killed in your mother's womb. But of course, there are competing rights, and there's the well-being and health of the woman and her right to look after herself. These are competing rights. I'm not... and also, there is then also people have different views as to when, you know, life starts. That's just the reality. And those arguments were well rehearsed during election times and referendums. It's just not quite as simple. I know when you've a certain point of view, regardless of what it is, you can see that so clearly. You can see that point so clearly. You can't understand why people don't agree with your point of view. I'm not speaking directly to you, listener. I'm speaking about us generally. Unfortunately, we all have different views on different topics, and you can't just make some big shout and as if all of a sudden we'll all agree or put our strongly held views to one side. Caroline, you might ask him to try again there. Hopefully in the next general election, the sooner better, we will have a great female Taoiseach. I think you can guess what party they're affiliated with. Hi, Greg. It's the no CCTV in Mallon. Also, these vandals are off their head. It's rife everywhere. Right, okay. I'm not sure as it relates to CCTV. I presume the Garda investigation is ongoing in that regard. And they'll probably find those responsible, let's put it like that. Hi, Greg. I've been thinking about your segment on alcohol that you did last week. I just felt I needed to put some balance on it. There once was a multiple of the number of pubs operating now than 20 years ago locally. From Muff to Claw, Redcastle, there was 10 pubs. There are now 5. Successive governments have brought in policies that have driven people from the relatively safe drinking environment of a pub to the no-limit drinking at home, the smoking ban, drink driving, the huge difference in price between home and bar drinking. Now, I'm not saying that some of these measures should not have been taken, but better preparation and planning should have gone into mitigating against the negative impacts of them. Price seems to be our government's weapon of choice when it comes to following the teetotaler agenda. Can I just say at this point, doctors and nurses and what have you, and we've seen it in Canada as well, accept, and it's generally accepted, that alcohol is a carcinogenic, that it causes cancer, that even relatively low levels of alcohol consumption can trigger cancers. This is well researched. So you're not going to have anyone in health effectively saying boozing is okay. That's just the reality. But I'll read on here, and that's why they increased the price. €5 now the norm for a pint, but the sad reality is that our young are finding other less expensive ways to entertain themselves on a night out. This I fully agree with. Drugs are at epidemic proportions in our communities, yet I rarely hear it mentioned. A young person can easily buy a bag of pot or weed much cheaper than a night's drinking, and they are everywhere, typically €20 for a night. They'll buy one drink at the bar, go for their fix, and be in a drunk-like state all night. I heard yesterday that there's now heroin in Inishowen, a drug that devastated communities in the 80s. Everyone knows who the dealers are and where to get any drugs of choice. Alcohol is not the only problem. And listen, I understand exactly where you're coming from as it relates to you need a dual approach. You know, if you are going to be talking about discouraging people from drinking, you have to accept there's a possibility that people then are going to be more inclined to turn to other highs like drugs, for example. Right, okay. Shall we take this break, get it out the road and clear the decks for Dr. Joe Kelly? Can you hear me, Joe?
I can. I hope you can hear me.
I can, loud and clear. Right, I'll take this quick break and that'll leave us pretty clear until 11. Stay where you are. Okay. Our historian in residence, Dr. Joe Kelly. Good morning to you, Joe. Great to have you on the show as always.
Imagine why I got Greg as a luck day checked. Good morning to yourself and to your listeners in Highland Radio.
Right, we are going to be talking about Marconi and the Irish and Donegal connection. Right, where should we start then?
At the beginning.
So has he an Irish background?
Yeah, well, you know, if you were to go by the FIFA regulations for soccer internationals, he would have qualified for Ireland. He could have played football for the Republic of Ireland. But look, Marconi's a very interesting man. Like, we talk maybe today about Steve Jobs, or we talk about the likes of Thomas Edison, you know, the bulb and different things like that. Steve Jobs, the iPhone and computers and the mouse and things like that. Well, what Marconi did for technology in the sense of wireless technology would be equivalent to that. And he's often called, you know, the father of modern technology in that sense, and wireless technology. So that's maybe a little bit of the background to the man. And he was born in Italy, in Bologna, in 1874. And this is where the Irish heritage comes in. His mother was Annie Jemison. Now, she was a granddaughter of John Jemison. You know the whiskey, famous John Jemison whiskey? Well, she was a granddaughter of John Jemison's. And she married this Italian man that would have been Marconi's father, and she lived in Italy. So, but he did come to Ireland from time to time, and particularly in Wexford, where his mother's grandparents, his maternal grandparents, that's where he would have come to stay and live for holidays and things like that. So we always had that connection with Ireland. And one must remember that stage, Ireland was still under the control of England, so it would have been seen as connected with England as well. And they would have been more aristocratic in the sense that they were wealthy, and his mum and dad were wealthy in Italy. And, you know, we talked before about the value of education and homework. He was self-educated. He had numerous languages, but he didn't have any formal education, like schooling education. But his mother encouraged him, kept encouraging him. And he then got in touch with a physicist in the University of Bologna, Augusto Righi. And he told him that he was interested in waves and how sound traveled in waves. And he told him about the different scholars that had done research. Now, oftentimes Marconi is accused of having stolen other people's work, but what he actually did was he read and learned about what others had done and brought it all together into a simplified form. So he wasn't reinventing the wheel, but he was making the wheel work more easier and far more dynamically. And that's what he did with wireless technology. And he'd read people like Maxwell and Lodge and Hertz. I mean, we all know the name Hertz with frequencies and whatnot. And he'd realized in 1888 that Hertz had discovered and produced the first wave, the first radio wave. And he was wondering how this could be done wirelessly. This was what his big ambition was. And he looked at things as...
So in other words, the waves that he would have drawn the inspiration from would have been running on a cable, effectively.
Yes. Yeah. And and for the communication of the time, everything needed a cable. Mm. And he said, well, can this be done without a cable?
Which is truly the biggest leap, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, initially getting to the moon. You couldn't get to the moon initially because how could you build a ladder long enough to reach the moon, as ridiculous as that may sound. So, you know, to it's great to be able to send sounds over a wire, but for it to have broad adoption, you need to sort of break that link.
Yeah, and it's his imagination that allowed him to do that. And in 1895, he made that breakthrough. Again, his mother had really encouraged him to explore his interest in the waves and the movement of electronics and magnetic fields and things like that. And he had his own laboratory in his own house up in his attic. And it was a room about 30 meters long, and he managed, or 30 feet long, sorry. And he managed to send a signal wirelessly from one end of the room to the other. And he went downstairs and got his mother, come up and look at what I have done. And then the father went looking for wires. He was going, well, where's the wires? And the father couldn't get over that he had done this. And he emptied his wallet and said, look, there you go. Mm. You know, that's amazing.
But before we talk more about that, you know, anytime there is new technology, and this is not a slight against anyone, but, you know, I remember it with, say, for instance, 3G, with deflector systems, more recently 5G, people concerned, people have this nervousness about what really is it all about, what's behind it, what can it do for us? And what really kind of happens is history repeats itself. You know, I was watching a clip last night about some Americans who were objecting to not being allowed to drink and drive. And they were using the language we use now, what's next? You know, we're not going to be able to do this, that and the other. It's communist country. We're going to be living... You know what I mean? So back then, what something that seemed magical, right? Almost like transportation, but audio transportation, teleportation almost. Did he have people that thought he was some sort of a wizard, or that this would be used, or there was some sort of, you know, ghosts involved or something?
Brilliant question. And at the point in 1895, when he was able to put this across his laboratory in his own house, he then wrote to the Italian government, the communications department, and told them about his invention. And they didn't reply back to him. And later they found a note saying that this must be somebody in an asylum that is thinking that we can do something wirelessly. He wasn't understood. And in fact, later on, we'll see when he went to look for funding, he actually was backed by 7 corn merchants here in Ireland. The men in Ireland at that time, as I said, were part of the British Empire, would have had money, you know, these corn merchants. And when he was in Dublin for a while, he met this man, Manlef Goodbody. I presume that's the Goodbodies that we talk about in business terms.
The brokers, is it? Ireland.
And he got him to come to his house in Clare in County Offaly. And he had prospective inspectors or investors with him as well. And he said, look, this is a young man I want you to meet. And look at his invention. He's looking for funding. And so they all arrived. Now, this is the time of carts and horses and so forth. And so he did arrive. The people arrived. And the next thing one of the, he did his experiment, and he said, look, I'll go to another room and I'll ring the bell in here in this room from another room. And he says, you can't do that. And he says, of course I can. And he says, somebody come with me. How many times do you want the bell to ring? And he kept them all in anticipation of what he could do. And they were dumbfounded. But one of the people there asked immediately for their carriage and horse. And the good body, Mr. Goodbody, says, what have I offended you? And he says, no, I'll have nothing to do with this sorcery. He's seen it as a work of the devil and of evil, that, you know, that you could communicate over the airwaves. So you're quite correct. A lot of people at the time probably thought what he was doing was mad. Mm. And at the time, there was cables running from America to Ireland, from Ireland to England. This was an unbelievable concept that you could send something wirelessly. And what about the curvature of the earth? And how would this be done? And he was very, and it was very, very simple what he did. It was so, so simple. And before long, in 1895, he did it in his own house for 30 feet. And then he went outside and he got it to the other side of the hill beside his house. And they had a shotgun and they would fire the shotgun to let them know that the signal had got to the other side of the hill. And over time, this it went further and further. So he got, his mother realizing that he was getting no satisfaction in Italy, took him to England. And the Post and Telegraphs there were very, very interested in what they, what he was doing.
Well, let me ask you before you talk about that.
Yeah.
At that time, what did they believe that this could be used for? Did they believe it could replace those wires that you talk of? Was it for, you know, military reasons? Did they imagine that you could have a news bulletin that someone could read the paper out on air or something? You know, like, in the early days, what did they believe this concept could be used for, I wonder?
Yeah, well, it's maybe like any invention. You know, you start off and you have a TV and it's black and white, and then somebody says, well, maybe you could do this in color, and then you could do flat screen, and then you could do a remote control. You wouldn't have to change buttons. And it escalated very, very fast. So what happened in that little room that he had his experiment in would eventually move into radio, would into TV, would into safety at the sea. It was just unbelievable. And he died before TV really got started. But has one invention led to another, to another, to another. The idea that you could communicate wirelessly opened up a massive... And today, you know, we take for granted 5G. We take for granted our phones. We take for granted so much. But the ingenuity and the mind that had to, you know, behind what you have in your hand or what you watch...
It's visionary. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So you were talking about then he moved from Italy. He was frustrated there, was he? And went to England, did you say?
Yeah, and I say again how important mothers are in our lives. She believed in him from day one, and she says, I'm taking you to England. We're going to try to get some money for you to develop this. And the Post and Telegraphs in England were very general, post office were really, really interested. William Pierce was his name. But they eventually took his experiment and stole some of his ideas and tried to do it independently of him. And because of that, then he patented his own, his wireless box. He patented that in 1896. In fact, he took out 800 different patents for his inventions, what he was doing, and eventually formed the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company. And that's why he came to Ireland to look for funding, when he'd seen what the Post and Telegraphs in England had done, you know, trying to take his invention and not have him involved with it. And they couldn't work it to the extent that he was using it. And in 1898, the Dunleary Regatta, would be known as Kingstown there at that time. Again, we were still under English rule. He was invited onto a boat. They'd hired a boat, a Dublin newspaper, the Dublin Daily Express, and he was out in the boat, able to send back signals to the port about where different boats were in the race. And it was the first time ever live reports could be sent back, and the newspaper was able to publish the results before the boats came back, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so remarkable.
So that was Ireland again.
It would have seemed like time travel at the time, in that know what's happening before the boats even return.
And at that time then, what he did was, he realised he could get a certain distance, so he went then to Rathlin, you see, Rathlin Island, and Ballycastle are pretty close in Antrim, so he could send a signal across there and manage it. And later on, that contraption that he used and station that he used in Ballycastle and Rathlin was moved to Malin, and we maybe talk about that
so
in a while.
So can we then also say, is he accredited with this? He then clearly is the first wireless sports reporter.
Well, technically, yeah.
Technically.
Done that. And he then went to when the Irish one had been so successful, they went and did that then in America. Some big yacht race in America followed. But he realised more than that. He realised what this potentially could do. And it was about, first of all, trying to extend his signal further and further. And he eventually got across the English Channel to France in 1899. And, you know, he realized the value of that there, and he kept on trying to move it out further and further. And eventually then he got it to the 2,000 miles. He was able to send a Morse code, the S, the signal S, the letter S, across 2,000 miles from Cornwall to Newfoundland. So once he realized he could send one signal in Morse code, eventually that would follow with voice signal, you know, that the voice could be carried. So he got the distance, and then he started elaborating it further and further, how he could harness that technology to transmit a voice, which is fascinating to consider that for thousands and thousands of years, human beings couldn't communicate at that distance. It must have been mind-boggling.
Well, all the while, the world is shrinking. You know, the further he could transmit that, the smaller the world would become. Now, this is great, right? It's almost doing tricks at this point, but of course he's displaying his wares.
Yes.
Then in terms of people sort of going, right, well, you've broadcast what's happening at Boats at Sea. You know, were people started to talk at that point, you know, how can we use this for safety reasons, for example? Like, I don't know how big the transmitter at that point might have been.
It wasn't terribly, terribly big. It was a little small black box. And what he'd realised, to try to get the signal with the wireless, he had little bits of metal, little particles of metal. And when the wireless signal would come, it would send electric fields through the little magnetic dust particles, and then they would make the connection between the two metal pieces, if you understand, the stable metal pieces. It was very, very simple what he did, and it was a little small black box. But yes, it was realized very quickly that this could be used for life-saving purposes on sea. That happened in one case, the East Goodwin lightship. It's in the English Channel, beside along by France and England there, and they had a lightship there to keep people off the rocks, and the lightship happened to have a Marconi box, and they signalled that there was a boat in distress that had gone through the fog and into a dangerous precarious position, and they rescued the people, and just because of Marconi's box. And then later on in 1909 there was an Italian ship that went on the rocks again. It had the Marconi system. It was about 1,700 people were saved. So they realised very, very quickly this was very, very important, and again it was the Marconi box that was used for the Titanic in April 1912, the signal that was sent out. And fortunately, Phillips, the signal man, the Marconi signal man, he actually drowned he stayed with the Marconi machine sending out the signal. And it was those signals that saved the people that did survive.
And I presume at the time, maybe I'm wrong to presume, that when they were promoting the safety of something, they'd go, we've got lifeboats, we've got perfectly trained staff, we've got a Marconi box. I wonder, did that form part of the safety message to try and entice people on really quite a long journey across the sea? I wonder, was it adapted like that?
Oh, absolutely. And people did realise, it wasn't even that. He was able to send news to the boats, the big boats, and they would print newspapers and then give it to the wealthy people on board so they could get the updated world news. It worked in reverse as well. He wasn't short of figuring out how he could use this to make financial gain. And so some boats had actually printed newspapers or reports and were able to give it so that people had an update of what was happening. And a boat at that time might be 6 weeks at sea going from, say, Ireland to America or going to Australia. Mm. So this allowed for communication to continue even at sea.
And things progressed very quickly then in terms of the initial, like, how long are we talking between sending that signal in his house to the wonderment of his family to some of the, you know, I mean, obviously we know that the Titanic was, what, almost two decades later. But how soon after that did we start seeing it being employed? Well, you mentioned the regatta there, actually. What year was that?
So it was really 1895. So that was very, very
close. So it moved really quite quickly, didn't it?
Yeah. And then by 1920, that had moved into radio land and Highland Radio, you know, Marconi again. And
some of the staff still work here. And come here.
None of them would have beards by any chance.
But, you know, it's like, I remember, and I think I mentioned it through one of these items before, I was a really early adapter with the mobile phone, and I remember sitting with no one to text, no one to call. I was the only person I knew that had this phone. I regretted it because I paid through the teeth for it. But at what time did for the masses, did receivers become generally available, I wonder?
Yeah, again, it was a big thing in the 20s and the 30s for young boys and possibly girls, but boys seem to have shown a bigger interest in it, to make their little, their own little radios. And they would buy the little magnet and the little wires and the little receiver and try to make so they could listen to radio. So in the 1920s, it really took off. And in fact, it was BBC that took his Marconi idea, the research centre there. And he used to broadcast concerts just free to air. And then BBC adopts it. Look, we'll work on this. And eventually then, actually, Marconi's company applied to the Irish newly formed Free State Government in the 1920s to get a licence to start up an Irish radio, 2RN. And I think that was about 1926 that was established, the first Irish radio station. And that was Marconi. And only for a few hours every day. I think it was 2 hours every day. And it didn't work very well outside Dublin. So what they did then is they started up a Cork radio. It was 6CK, 6 Cork CK. And then later on, the Athlone radio was set up in 1933. And that was to boost the signal as well, or to rebroadcast some of the programmes. So, and he also was involved in setting up Vatican Radio that still goes in 1931.
So obviously the military would have been looking on at this with great interest. Would they have, or did they have their own means of communication, or what?
Obviously they realised the potential of this, the value of this. I mean, to consider, for example, that an Armistice Day, the treaty of 1919, it was signed, and yet people still died a day later. They were still fighting in the trenches at the front because the communication hadn't got to the front, even though the peace had been signed behind it. So, I mean, and we had one case in Donegal, Joe McHugh from Doohery, fighting in World War One. The war was over. The parents were relieved, only to find out that he was killed the day after the war was over. Wow. Because the fighting continued. So military right away realised the value of this. And in fact, Mussolini had enlisted him into World War One. Well, this was before Mussolini. The Italians had enlisted him into World War One to see what they could do with his technology and how they could use it. And then later on, Mussolini, after 1922, enlisted him into his fascist party. And there's questions over Mussolini's involvement with fascism. But it would be more, historians would say, look, it was more a matter of business and finance than ideology. And that he wasn't necessarily, you know, supporting the fascist ideology and what went with it. So there was always a kind of little bit of a controversy or a question there. But certainly, yeah, they did realise the use of his. And obviously, over time, they would advance that in different ways, as we know today.
Right, OK. So let's go to Malin then. Yes. Because there was a communication tower there long before Marconi.
What was there initially, and how, because I have this, was told this story,
like they used to, you know, they would daisy chain messages around the coast, right? We've talked about that before. Obviously, how that was done with lights, wires, what? Remind us.
Well, it was called semaphone. Sema is the Greek word for a sign, and phone is a carrier, a flag carrier. You know, they would use flags to make signals to boats. And see, at the time, that had been Lloyd's of London in 1805. And Lloyd's were underwriters for insurance for boats, companies for boats. So at all times, they had developed a system whereby they would know roughly where all the boats in the world's oceans were at any one time by these signal stations. So there was a signal station in Malin about 1805, an old signal station there. Boats would come close to Malin, to Bamba's Crown, where it is, and they would be able to then relay that back to Dublin, and then from Dublin to London to Lloyd's, where what ship it was, what time they'd be expecting to arrive at, how many passengers, all those details were able to pass on. And what Marconi realised then was there was a value in being able to know digitally using his wireless connection to boats, not necessarily having to be you know, see physically the boat, that they could actually signal the boats without actually seeing them, and could guess what time they would be there at and how far they were advanced. We talked about the Titanic and safety. So he realized fairly quickly that Ireland was geographically a gateway to the Atlantic and America and Canada and a lot of, you know, ocean liners and traveling. So he set up various signal stations. Once he made the connection with Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, he then decided, right, okay, I need to use Ireland. And he built a number of stations, transatlantic links. There was one in Cork in 1901, one in Rosslare, Wexford, 1901, and then Malin Head was 1902. He had one in Kerry then in Valencia, and then he had a massive one in Clifton in about 1907, 250 people working in it. But wow. the Malin one, as I said to you, it was 1902, and he took the contraption and utensil that he had used in Rathlin and Ballycastle to Malin, and they took over what was the old Lloyd's signal station and built a new station there, and he put up a 120-foot aerial there, and the first commercial message was sent to a ship, the SS Lake Ontario, in January 1902, and that continued up to about 1909, and then the post office took over the Marconi station, whatever kind of financial agreement or understanding was there. So that really was the Marconi had no longer any part to play with that, but he had a connection with Donegal in that sense, and he realised the importance of Banba's Crown, or at the top of
And where did Banba's Crown? That's quite it's a lovely name. It kind of rolls off the tongue a little bit. Where what's the origins of it?
Well, the people of Malin can claim this. It's a wonderful thing to claim. Banba was one of the three sisters, Era, Banba and Foldla. There were three old names for Ireland. There were three sisters of, supposedly in mythology, the Tuatha De Danann, and they were very beautiful girls. So when the Malaysians, the Celts arrived, the three girls said, look, name Ireland after me, and they decided to name it after Era. But poetically, people would use Foldla or Banba. So Banba is another old Irish name for Ireland. So Banba's Crown, the crown of Ireland, and sure isn't that Donegal, and I'm sure the people of Malin have a right claim to that. And, you know, from a tourism point of view,
sure,
it says a lot that we are the crown of Ireland, and oftentimes we maybe not feel that, but we need to keep believing it, and maybe the people of Malin will remind us more often.
All right, and very finally, I mean, obviously the father of radio, when did he die, and was his death marked particularly, I suppose, on his invention?
Very, very interestingly, like, he died in 1937. He was 63 when he died, and it's the only time seemingly in radio history that the actual signals went silent when his mass or his ceremony, his burial ceremony, was being broadcast. For 2 minutes, all the signals of radio land went quiet out of respect for Marconi. And I don't think that has ever been repeated since. So, look, we have a lot to be grateful for, Greg. They wouldn't be listening to you and your show every morning only for what Marconi had invented.
So it's his fault.
We have somebody to blame now. And his day, Marconi Day, is celebrated on the 25th of April, the Saturday nearest to the 25th of April. And so, look, we can be proud in one sense that there's a Donegal connection and there's an Irish connection. And more importantly, the importance of a mother in a child's education and her persistence and her belief in her child, you know, help to create someone who you could say is the man who connected, networked the whole world. So there's Marconi, there's Donegal, and there's a bit of Jameson.
And there's Dr. Joe Kelly, historian. Joe, thanks so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate it. So that's it. Marconi and his Irish and Donegal connections. Hope you enjoyed that.